Music has served as a form of political and social expression in the U.S. going back to the Revolutionary War and beyond. When we think of protest music, we might jump to the Vietnam War era of the 1960s and 70s, like Fortunate Son by Creedence Clearwater Revival. But artists throughout the 20th century and on to today continue to write songs that offer commentary on pressing issues. What's changed over the years? Is the golden age of the protest song over, or have things just changed? You can join in at 800-642-1234. When I say protest music, what does that mean to you? What do you think of? What era do you think of? What performer or song? Is there a song or artist from a particular time that stays with you? Do you notice when music has a political or social message behind it? Do you want music to have political or social messages behind it, or do you want music to get away from those things? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Alexander Shashko is a lecturer in the Department of Afro-American Studies at UW-Madison who teaches about music and culture. He's also a voter for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Alexander, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. It's nice to be back.
Well, I imagine protest music has been around since there was music, but when did it really get mainstream popularity in the U.S., when, you know, it wasn't just the people, you know, singing it, but it became part of pop culture?
Well, that's a great question. Of course, there has been, as you noted, music about protest and music about politics as long as we have had music. If you think about it, songs about war are certainly songs that are political, and those are among the oldest songs we have in human culture. So the idea of having political music has always existed, and it has always existed in the United States. In every single era, we have songs that are about the political conditions that we are in, songs of protest as well. In the modern recorded era, you can find songs about the Depression. You can find songs about World War II. There's really no era in which there isn't music about politics and protest, whether it's about the economy and poverty, whether it's about war, whether it's about the changes in society, whether it's about race relations or gender. They have always been there. But in the modern era that really starts with the birth of rhythm and blues and rock and roll, it is the 60s, the mid 60s into the early 70s, that is the first period that we really look at a moment when there is a kind of merging of protest music and popular music, popular hits that are consistently songs about what is going on in American society in explicit ways. So that's really the moment when it starts in that particular era. And it is also, you know, in part a way in which we periodize that, because that is the moment that many of us first remember that popular political music emerging.
Is there a significant difference between, you know, a song with political lyrics and songs that people might sing at a protest? You know, is there something different with the communal experience of singing "We Shall Overcome" at a civil rights rally, or "This Land Is Our Land" or whatever, versus, you know, a song that you kind of passively listen to?
Well, obviously, it can be a different experience. If you are listening to the song by yourself in isolation, or if you're driving in your car, it may have you thinking about politics. It may have you contemplating political action in some form or another, but you're by yourself. And so the relationship is between your own thoughts and the art itself. That is part of the call and response, the longstanding tradition in which music helps to form community and creates a kind of dialogue between the art and individuals. But that becomes much more straightforward and explicit when it happens in a communal setting. So if people are singing the music together at a march, at a protest, in a performance, then there is a kind of shared sense of identity and a shared sense of purpose that comes out of singing that song and relating it to the situation that you are in.
Let's dive into songs related to civil rights now. You sent us some suggestions for influential or important protest-related songs. "People Get Ready" by Curtis Mayfield and the Impressions from 1965, kind of a movement anthem. Here's a listen.
People get ready, there's a train a-coming. You don't need no baggage, you just get on board.
The those of us listening with headphones getting a stereo there back and forth. Alexander, why did songs like that one, People Get Ready, resonate well with people in the fight for civil rights?
So the fight for civil rights was a longstanding one for African Americans. Of course, as long as African Americans have been on this continent, they have struggled to gain civil rights and to have equal opportunity to be both citizens and to be politically active in American society. So it has always been part of the African American struggle. And that struggle has been at times very deeply tied to the church. The church was a location where people could gather, where African Americans could gather, where they could talk about the struggles that they were experiencing, where they could escape from those struggles and find refuge and community and joy. And so the sounds of gospel music have long been a sound that African Americans have used as a way to express their view of the world, including through politics. Now, that has often been metaphorical through gospel music, and it's one of the reasons why African Americans could get away with singing those songs, because they were metaphorical as opposed to being explicit. As we get into the era of rhythm and blues and soul, what we see are artists who are deeply grounded in the gospel tradition and in the gospel impulse, the idea of finding redemption or finding a better place both in this world and beyond, and they translate it into secular music. So as they do that, they take many of the sounds of community, of redemption, of gathering together to make progress, and they translate them from a purely religious setting into one that is more or less secular. And that's what a song like People Get Ready by Curtis Mayfield does. Curtis Mayfield, who was from Chicago, was deeply connected to church music, and then took that lesson and those experiences and brought them into the pop music that he was creating. So a song like People Get Ready is about the train to Jordan. It is not just literally about that, but it is also, even more importantly, metaphorically, about the idea of finding a way for people to get to the promised land, to get to the place that they want to be, where they can find happiness, where they can find freedom. And that's really the purpose of the song.
We are talking about the history of protest music in the United States with Alexander Shashko, who teaches about music and culture at UW-Madison. You can join in with your questions, maybe your favorite songs, artists, memories of protest music at 800-642-1234. Brian joins us now in Green Bay. Brian, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Brian?
Well, I wanted to bring up a band that is alternative rock or maybe punk rock in its origin that started in, I believe, the 90s, known as Rage Against the Machine. And they were a political band that decided to do the opposite of the Gospels, actually. Instead of being metaphorical, they were very direct in their message. And singer, songwriter, and activist lead singer, the indefatigable Zach De La Rocha, and the guitarist, Mr. Tom Morello, who is insurmountable in his talents, both have continued to create music and are continuing to be on tour given the time and age that we live in, and continue to spread a political message that is a bit more in your face. And the band name being Rage Against the Machine seems to speak for itself, in my opinion, as to their message and their purpose as a band.
Brian, thanks for the call. Alexander.
Well, you're not going to hear me disagree with you about the importance of Rage Against the Machine. I actually did vote for them when they were a nominee for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this year. They did not get in. I think it's probably a matter of time before they do. But in any event, I absolutely agree about Rage Against the Machine being a really important band in the history of both rock music and also the history of protest music. Tom Morello is an incredibly innovative guitarist, and the group really took on the mantle of protest bands that had come before them, both from the world of rock and punk in particular, but also from hip hop. And part of what makes Rage Against the Machine such a powerful group is that they're really probably the most both musically influential and politically active of all of the bands that are kind of rap rock hybrid groups, the groups that draw from both the rock tradition and the hip hop tradition. And so what you hear when you listen to Rage Against the Machine is a group that is drawing on groups from the MC5 to the Clash, on the rock side of things, but also drawing from groups like Public Enemy on the hip hop side of things. And in the process, bringing together a kind of fusion of those two worlds that is also meant to represent a way of bridging those two worlds and looking for common cause, because it's often the case, both with musical genres and with protests, that they often can't hear one another or can't work with one another because they're so devoted to the particular issues that they're dealing with. And part of what Rage Against the Machine was trying to accomplish, both symbolically through their sound and explicitly through their lyrics, was to bring those two worlds together.
Brian, thanks for the call. I'm sorry, we didn't pull any Rage Against the Machine, but in these more in-your-face style, Alexander, you just mentioned Public Enemy. Here's their 1988 Fight the Power.
Gotta give us what we want. Gotta give us what we need. Hey, our freedom of speech is freedom of death. We got to fight the powers that be. Fight the power. Fight the power.
So, Alexander, the hip-hop thread there, obviously a very different sound than the more mellow Curtis Mayfield we heard earlier.
Absolutely. A different sound. Although certainly there was a point later when Curtis Mayfield was a lot closer to Public Enemy than he was with People Get Ready. But yeah, that is the sound of frustration and of anger. But above all, it's really a sound that is just trying to get people's attention. For many African-Americans, especially younger generations of African-Americans in the 1980s, they felt that their voices were not being heard in the political discourse of the day, that much of the dialogue about race relations was, in their view, a kind of tired discussion of whether or not the civil rights movement had fully succeeded, about whether or not race relations was something that had been somehow resolved in the 1960s, and that there really wasn't a lot more to talk about. And what a group like Public Enemy was trying to accomplish was to be heard through all of that static, and to be heard when there was a lot of silence about the experience that young African-Americans and young African-American men in particular were experiencing and dealing with. And so they created both lyrics that were purposefully confrontational and more importantly, in my opinion, a sound that was purposely confrontational, that they wanted the sound of sirens. They wanted the sound of the city. They wanted a chaotic kind of sound that would grab you by the lapels and force you to pay attention to them so that you couldn't turn away from the things that they wanted to say. And in that sense, they really took political hip hop to a different level. It had already existed. Grandmaster Flash's and the Furious Five's The Message, of course, was the first big political hip hop song. And there were groups like Boogie Down Production. But Public Enemy really take it to an entirely different level. They make politics the centerpiece of the music that they're creating and thus create an opening for hip hop artists to be more politically engaged through their music.
We're talking about the history and evolution of protest music in the U.S. with UW-Madison lecturer Alexander Shashko. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, your favorites, your memories about protest music. 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation, hear from more of you coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. That's Bruce Springsteen's 1984 hit, Born in the USA, his response to the end of the Vietnam War and how veterans were treated when they returned home. We continue our talk about protest and political music, how it's changed across the decades. Alexander Shashko is with us, lecturer in the Department of Afro-American Studies at UW-Madison, who teaches about music and culture. Let's go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Gail is with us in Fish Creek. Gail, hi.
Hi. Oh, well, it goes back. The tried and true Buffalo Springfield 1966, for what it's worth. Everybody's right, but everybody's wrong. And that goes with every battle, every outcry, every protest we've ever had, and we're still having with an adulterated Supreme Court going against women's reproductive rights. It's right there. And then my second is Richie Havens, Freedom. That is just a constant. He sang his heart out at Woodstock and made that song. And if it's not everybody's anthem, it should be.
Gail, thanks for the call. And that was interesting, Alexander. She talked about how the same song, in this case, For What It's Worth, can apply to a lot of different situations. A lasting protest song may fit a lot of different circumstances.
Absolutely. And that is a song that has survived through the years, that any time there has been a moment of political turmoil, especially regarding war, For What It's Worth has emerged again. It is a song that not only got played again when the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan began, but it was covered artists at that time and sampled. And in fact, Stephen Stills is actually on a Public Enemy song in which they sample For What It's Worth, a song called He Got Game. And so that tradition of taking those old songs and reimagining them in a new era has lived on to this day. It's certainly lived on into the era of hip hop. And that has happened for a long time. If you think about what artists like Richie Havens were doing during the folk revival, much of what they were doing was to draw from political folk music from an earlier era, from the 1920s or 30s or 40s, and then to both, you know, play those songs again in the context of a new time and draw off of those musical traditions to create new songs to fit the times that they are in. So both of those artists and those songs that they performed really represent a link in the chain of tradition, both past and into our present day, in which those songs live on as anthems for a kind of protest that people want to engage in.
Thanks for that call, Gail. We'll go to Tom now in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. There was a song that was sung a lot during the Vietnam War era. It was written by a folk singer, Native American woman, Buffy St. Marie, and it was covered by a British folk singer, Donovan, called The Universal Soldier. It spoke about how patriots of any country fight for love of their own country.
Tom, thanks for the call. Alexander?
Yeah, that is absolutely a song that sort of creates this complex scenario in which it is engaging in both the questions of the importance of war, but also the importance of country and identity and who's responsible for fighting. Is a soldier someone who is responsible for making the choices about whether they fight or whether they are, or are they someone who is, you know, being asked to do their part for the community within which they live? You know, ultimately what it says is that everyone needs to be responsible for their own actions and everyone needs to make their own choices. And of course, in the context of the Vietnam War, that was a very, very heated subject because between the draft and those who were choosing to fight, there were a lot of hard individual choices between a sense of duty, a sense of patriotism to country, and then a sense of patriotism to ideas, or a sense of justice and in terms of fighting war and of being someone who's willing to kill in order to win that war. And so that those kind of complicated questions are always part of any kind of protest music tradition, especially when it comes to war. There's a whole subgenre of music, and it's really not a subgenre, it's its own genre, that are songs about the experience of the soldiers themselves. And Fortunate Son, which you played earlier, is a prime example of that. That is a song that is not taking a position so strongly on the import or on the on whether or not the Vietnam War should be fought, but rather on who is fighting it and what the consequences are for both those who fight it and those who do not. So that question about individual responsibility and the choices that we make is one that we often hear when it comes to political music, and especially political music about war.
Thanks a lot for that call. I want to take our last few minutes, Alexander, to look at political music today. I think it's easy to turn and say, okay, yeah, the 60s, early 70s, that was the golden age, not so much anymore. You don't buy that, though.
I do not. There is lots of political music. Now, there are a few reasons why that may not seem as apparent as it has in the past. One is that there's just so much music today that there's more of everything, including protest music. It's also the case that in the internet age and in the world of streaming that we're in, and in a world of instantaneous and mass amounts of information, a protest song doesn't quite have the same kind of time to gather an audience and to become anthemic, because there's just so much popular culture that passes through us on any given day, let alone a week or in a month. And so it's a little bit harder for it to stand out than it had before, but it still does happen. If you think about just a few years ago, a song like All Right by Kendrick Lamar or Formation by Beyonce, typically at a moment when there are social movements going on, those songs then start to have a greater resonance than they would otherwise. The real key to protest music becoming memorable is if there's a movement behind it. It's a kind of symbiotic relationship. The songs are inspired by the movement. The movement is inspired by the songs. The movement might create some of the language or take some of the acts that an artist will then use to write a song. And at the same time, they might be articulating the sentiments of people in the movement that they may not have articulated otherwise for themselves, and they can now sing it in a kind of communal setting. So there is absolutely protest music today. There is lots of protest music today, but it doesn't quite exist in the same kind of cultural and technological context. And I do think that has made a difference in terms of how broadly people recognize it, hear it, and understand it.
Alexander, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
That's Alexander Shashko, lecturer in the Department of Afro-American Studies at UW-Madison, with us today for a look at the history of protest music in the United States.